All right. My name is Joel Muggy. This is the fourth session in the series on Central America. This one entitled Honduras, Establishing a U.S. Beachhead. Some people have been here for a while writing letters to Congress people. Those of you who just came in, we found out this morning that yesterday House of Representatives voted 220 to 198, we think the vote is, against continuation of covert aid aimed at overthrowing the Nicaraguan government. Now, this is something to become the force of law, also has to be approved by the Senate and so forth, but it is generally considered to be a very strong statement against the Reagan policy on Central America, and hopefully will be a blow to that policy. And the best I think we can hope for is that will it cause the administration to consider at least a bit more intently the possibility of negotiated settlement in this area. At the same time that this happened, of course, we noted yesterday that the day before yesterday, Reagan announced the sending of 4,000 U.S. troops into Honduras as, and this is a quote, it's quoted at least in the Wenatchee World, or whatever that paper's called, a clear demonstration, this is the sending of troops now, a clear demonstration of our commitment to the democratic nations of the region. For Reagan, that means El Salvador, Guatemala, and especially Honduras. The character, I want to focus today on Honduras, because Honduras has become such a critical focal point for U.S. foreign policy. And I want to begin by talking about the character of this so-called democracy. And I think the character of this so-called democracy is characterized by the recent experience of a group of which I was a part and was the leader that traveled to Honduras just a little over a month ago. So I want to take a little different tack than I have in the previous days, and I want to talk the first part of today's presentation about what happened in that experience. Very revealing, I think. Perhaps symbolic of that experience, as we landed in San Pedro Sula, I should maybe tell you a little about Honduras, first of all. Let's do that. This is Honduras. It sets in relation to the other countries in Central America, right here, surrounded by Nicaragua, Salvador, and Guatemala. So you see at once, first geopolitically, why it plays such an important role. Nicaragua, now in the midst of having experienced a revolution, Salvador and Guatemala both engaged in with the strong popular struggles against the governments of these countries. This is sort of a very strategically located spot, at least for U.S. foreign policy. We landed first of all in San Pedro Sula, which is here in the north, which is the center of much of the fruit company activity. There's also a military base right adjacent to the airport, and I think a good symbol of Honduras is as we were landing, there were three U.S. Army military men jogging along the runway. That was just the first symbol of a very heavy U.S. presence that we saw in Honduras. Our problems began in this. Keep in mind now, I want you to keep in mind through all I'm talking about, that the United States holds up Honduras as one of the model democracies in Central America. And I want those of you who are here with my description of Nicaragua, I want you to hear what I'm saying in contrast to that. Our problems began with our arrival at the San Pedro Sula airport. This was a group of 20-some people now, basically a combination of group of students, some priests and pastors, a couple nuns, and people from all walks of life, a group much like this one. We had valid 30-day visas issued by the Honduran consulate, which were multiple entry visas, good for 2 years, but good for 30 days each time we entered. In other words, this is something that's that they have no re the they have no re legal right to prevent us from entering once we have those visas. We were detained for 2 hours at the airport while the officials discussed whether or not they were going to let the group in. Their explanation was that for our detention was that, well, this is a group and we didn't know you were coming. Well, I mean, nobody has, you don't have to notify the Honduran group government that a group is coming. I mean, that's not, you know, in the immigration rules. And what we really discovered was that on our cards that we filled out, we indicated that we were going to stay at a Jesuit retreat center located in a small village near San Pedro Sula. Well, the Jesuits are well known in Honduras because they've been very much supportive of human rights issues in Honduras, and they've been involved in working among the poor. The fact that we were going to stay at the Jesuit center made us very suspect. Eventually, we were given permission to enter after about 2 hours. But our visas were ignored, and we were given tourist cards that allowed us to stay in the country 3 days. And only after a 24-hour wait and the intervention of the head of immigration of the country of Honduras were our visas extended so that it would fit with our itinerary, and we needed to stay at least 4 days. The real issue at stake here was their uneasiness about independent Americans moving throughout the country trying to understand the tensions in Honduras. They were nervous because we were going to stay with the Jesuits, and in fact, it turns out, the next day the head of the Jesuits where we were staying got a call from the Archbishop of San Pedro Sula saying, "What is this I hear that you have a group of Jesuits and nuns staying at the La Fragua, as it's called?" Well, somehow immigration had got the idea that this was a group of religious people. And religious people are very threatening to a country in which human rights are under scrutiny. Also, it's important to note that we entered the country in an area dominated by the United Fruit Company and the Standard Fruit Company, an area where there had recently been much labor strife, including the disappearance of key labor leaders. In fact, we spoke to many labor leaders in that area of the country who indicated that they were putting themselves in great danger simply by meeting with us. I think it's telling at the end of one of our meetings, one of the labor union leaders told us in a sort of a joking way, but it wasn't very funny, "Welcome to Honduras, but don't stay long because people disappear here." He said it in a joking way, but it was very, very true and rather striking for us. I still remember that morning feeling very nervous for the people who were speaking to us, especially in the light of the experience that we'd had at the airport. I should also mention at the airport that while we were waiting for these 2 hours, they let us go outside. And it was almost a caricature of, there were about three men in dark glasses leaning against telephone posts watching us the whole time, which were generally, everyone is I mean, it's just a given, they're members of what's called the DNI, which is the secret police of Honduras, which has been, many of the disappearances and deaths have been attributed to them. Now, I still remember that we spent an afternoon or morning with these labor union leaders in which they were sharing some of the ideas and the struggle that they saw was necessary in Honduras, and really being fearful for them because of the fact that they were talking to us in this way. Well, it turns out we were justified in that fear because the next day we traveled by bus from San Pedro Sula, which as I said is here in the north, down to Tegucigalpa, which is the capital of Honduras. And on the highway there are three checkpoints where all trucks and public vehicles, buses especially, must stop. Honduran citizens are often required to sign their names here, It's an interesting way for security forces to monitor movements of citizens in this democratic country. At the first of these checkpoints, our bus was stopped and boarded by two armed members of FUSEP, which is the National Police of Honduras. They checked our passports very carefully, went all the way through the bus, checked our passports, and then a member of the DNI came on the bus in their plain clothes. Again, these are the secret police, I mean, they're thugs is what they are. I mean, that's what they look like, too. He also checked our passports and asked us a number of questions. And it was very clear from his questions that he knew precisely who we were and where we had come from. And in fact, the driver of our bus afterwards said he knew who you were. It became apparent that our movements in the country were being monitored at that time. Then we came to the second checkpoint, about 45 minutes down the road. Two more members of FUSEP came on the bus, checked our passports again. It should be noted that in our passports we also had Nicaraguan visas in order to go to Nicaragua, which again was one of the things I think that brought us under scrutiny, right?
Mention there that it might be something to think about in the future, whether you shouldn't carry two sets. The U.S. government does that for people in the Near East, for Israel and the Arab.
Right, except in this case, it would be more difficult, I think, to get that from the U.S. government, because the U.S. government is not interested in our traveling to both of those countries. and this time, they checked our passports, and then they began to search all our luggage. And in searching the luggage, they confiscated a variety of written materials. They confiscated a description of our program and the itinerary. But more seriously, they confiscated some brochures that had been given to us by one of the labor groups, which I don't think it had names on it, but at least could be used in reprisals against the labor organization. It was clear, of course, that then we had met with them. We got those somewhere, although we told them, somebody just handed it to us on a street because they asked, where'd you get this? It was a very, very, very intimidating kind of experience for people. They confiscated, for example, a Mexican newspaper that one of the people had called Uno Mas Uno, which is a very progressive newspaper in Mexico. And another thing that was very disturbing, we had one Uruguayan woman in the group, an Uruguayan citizen. They took her name and they wrote her name down in a little book, which then for the rest of that trip made her very, very nervous. I mean, she had lived in a society all her life where repression is the name of the game in Uruguay. And so her just having her name in a book, recognizing that the Uruguayan ambassador in Honduras probably wouldn't protect her in any way if she got into some difficulty, later in the visit, we had someone from Honduras, the head of the Human Rights Commission, say to her, your only protection, if they decide to do something, is the solidarity of the group that you're with. You will get no protection from the Uruguayan ambassador. So all of these kinds of experiences building up it was a very, very intimidating experience for the group, but also a very powerful one in understanding the nature of Honduran democracy. That evening, once we arrived in Tegucigalpa, we met with Dr. Ramon Custodio, who's president of the Honduran Human Rights Commission. Dr. Custodio's status has been compared by many to that of Oscar Romero, the Bishop of Salvador, who was assassinated by the right wing, or by the most assumed by the government in El Salvador, because of his outspoken statements and outspoken advocacy of human rights in Honduras, and because of his urging of the end to U.S. Military support to Honduras. Dr. Custodio spoke to us about the growing repression in Honduras, about arrests without charge, detaining people without charging them, about long detentions without trials, and about disappearances, torture, and political murders that are increasingly happening in Honduras. He spoke of the hope which had existed a year and a half ago when Honduras elected, in a relatively free election, a civilian government which replaced many years of military rule. And he grieved over what he considered to be a betrayed democracy and about the growing political power and control of the Honduran military over this civilian government. He confirmed what we had heard from many Hondurans about the real chain of command in Honduras, as it really exists, that the real power in Honduras is wielded by the U.S. Embassy under the Ambassador Negroponte. The second in command is the head of the Honduran army, Alvarez, and the third, the president of Honduras, Suazo Cordova. So that what we're seeing is Honduras very gradually, even though it is in a military government, a civilian government, the military is having increasing control, partly and mostly because of U.S. pressure in that direction. Many fear that Dr. Custodio will soon be killed, and yet he speaks with a tremendous power and courage in which one really senses a man who has walked across death. I mean, he has made that commitment, and death no longer holds any power over him, in much the same way that Romero had lived and had come in his life struggle. The fictional nature of Honduran democracy became even more clear to us in our meetings with the Deputy Chief of Mission at the U.S. Embassy, whose name was Shepard Lohman. He's second in command to Negroponte. I should mention also that within the last 2 years, the U.S. Embassy in Honduras has been upgraded from a Class D embassy to a Class B embassy, which puts it on a par with the embassies of Mexico and very important embassies around the world. And there's been a huge influx of personnel into this tiny country in Honduras. Let me give you a feel for the kind of thing Shepard Lohman was saying. It's very, on all our trips to Latin America, it's very critical for us to go to the U.S. Embassy because it's almost often the most telling parts of our experience. Lohman indicated that the military plays a strong role in Honduras, perhaps much more acceptable than would be the case in the United States, he said. He insisted that Alvarez, the head of the military, respects the constitutional government headed by Suazo Cordova, although at one point when he was talking about wanting to say that Suazo Cordova makes certain decisions, he slipped and said, most of the decisions are made by Suazo Cordova, he said, President Suazo Cordova. He almost slipped into saying General Alvarez. He said that the military had supported the transition to civilian rule. The military had supported this transition to civilian rule because the economy was collapsing and the military did not want to be held responsible. So even here we have the implication that this transition to civilian rule has happened only because the military wanted it to happen. And that is in fact the case. He said that Alvarez and Suazo Cordova shared many common goals and needed each other. When asked why they needed each other, he said, and this is a quote, they know it would be much more difficult to get as much U.S. assistance if there is a military government in Honduras. In other words, the facade of civilian rule makes a huge Honduran military buildup possible. And it allows Reagan to use Honduras as the base from which to carry out his foreign policy goals in the region. And that includes the destabilization of Nicaragua and the intensification of war in El Salvador. Now, it's very interesting, this relationship between Alvarez, the head of the military, and the president of Honduras, Suazo Cordova. I don't know how many of you read Time magazine in June 13th. There was an interview with each of them, Suazo Cordova and General Alvarez, really trying to get at this. Who really runs Honduras? And one of the questions or the areas they asked was on the relationship with each other. When Suazo Cordova, the president, was asked about his relationship with General Alvarez, he said, "The orders of the president to the chief of the armed forces are obeyed. The day they are not obeyed, I will just go home. So far, my orders are being obeyed." On his relationship with President Suazo Cordova, General Alvarez said, "This has been the hobby horse of enemies of Honduras who want to isolate the government. They would like to say the government is all a facade. In Honduras, the president is the one who rules and his orders are respected. The armed forces of Honduras have learned a lot in the past few years. We would be irresponsible and commit a crime against our country if we did not respect the duly elected representative of our people. The day the president of this republic gives me an order I do not like, I will leave my position." So what we have here is a general who says, as soon as that president gives me an order I don't like, I'll quit. And the president saying, as soon as the head of the army doesn't obey my orders, I'll go home. The president can say that because he's not giving the orders. And the general of the army can say that because he is giving the orders. The fact is that the military is very much in control in Honduras. And most observers in Honduras suggest, and there's ample evidence to suggest that, that in fact, civilian elections were allowed to be held because Suazo Cordova was forced to give concessions to the army. One of the concessions is that the army is not held responsible for its actions. There can be no retribution against any illegal activity on the part of the army. No, it's part of the relationship of government that's been worked out, and that the army is primarily responsible for foreign policy. When asked about confiscation of materials, we told the deputy chief of mission about our experience in having materials confiscated, he said that the Honduran authorities would have known who we were meeting with anyway, as a part of the natural course of events. All right? Did you catch that? That the authorities normally would have known who we were meeting with. Well, how would they have known that unless we were under surveillance? When asked about numerous reports of disappearances, he became obviously very flustered. And this is a quote, and I'm going to try to say it in the way that he said it, because we couldn't believe this happened. We asked about the reports that we'd got about disappearances, and he said, "There are disappearances, and then there are disappearances. I mean, have these people disappeared, or have they disappeared?" And we sort of sat there, and he seemed to want us to convince us that these disappeared people were on vacation. I'm not sure his purpose, but that was his response to our question about disappearances. Somehow the implication, well, they really haven't disappeared. After meeting with the U.S. ambassador, we met with the president of the Honduran Assembly, the president of the Honduran Congress. His name is Efrain Bujeron. He's one of the blandest individuals I've ever met in my life, but that's beside the point. When asked whether or not U.S. support for Honduran military, an increasing role of the military in Honduran politics, was undermining the democracy in Honduras, and also get the same response when we asked about Honduran support for counter-revolutionaries seeking to overthrow the Nicaraguan government, his response was, "These are political matters, and therefore they do not concern me." This is the head of the Congress of Honduras who's saying that political matters don't concern him. And when asked about human rights violations and disappearances, he says, "These are matters for the police. I don't know anything about this." Okay, so when the president of the Assembly of Honduras says human rights and the role of the military do not concern him, then one must question, I think, the real existence of democracy in Honduras. Recently, the U.S., and we were talking about this before, the U.S. has decided to establish a new base here at Puerto Castilla.
Oh, where is it? Here we are. Can't find it now. It's on the northern coast, at least.
A new base at Puerto Castilla, the purpose of which is not to train Hondurans, but to train El Salvadoran military. Because Congress has set a limit of 55 U.S. advisors in El Salvador, so we don't have to follow that. To get around that rule, what we've done is established a base in Honduras in order to train Salvadoran military, and we were training up to 1,500 people at a time at this base. Well, this was a decision that was made between the General of the Army in Honduras and the U.S. State Department, and it was only after the fact and after construction had begun on this base that this issue was debated in the assembly in Honduras. Okay, so the real role of the Honduran assembly is really up for, can be questioned, I think. So that's just some of the dimensions of our experiences in Honduras. I'll touch on a few more of those a little bit later, but I want to dig a little bit more deeply into the current dynamics of the situation in Honduras. The Honduran economy at this moment is in deep recession. Unemployment is estimated at 20% and underemployment at 60% in Honduras. It is the poorest country in Central America. Now, I gave you a bunch of figures on Guatemala and El Salvador the other day. The situation in Honduras is even more desperate. There were democratic elections and a return to civilian rule in 1981. But the leading political politicians in Honduras seem to be spectators in their own political game, even though the mandate in the election was clearly one of trying to eliminate military rule in Honduras. The military has the decisive decisive role in most important decisions and is accountable really only to itself. The newly elected president, Suazo Cordova, has a very serious problem. How does he try to demilitarize a country? The voters clearly want the country demilitarized, when the country's major ally, the United States, is supporting militarization. And the United States deals with the military. They treat the military as if they're in control. And when the United States does that, that essentially gives them that power. And they do that both rhetorically and materially. It's clear that the real power is held by the military and that the order of things, as I indicated before, is reinforced by the United States. There's a very close relationship between the U.S. Ambassador, Negroponte, and the head of the military, General Alvarez. In fact, it's a Honduran officer who recently defected from the Honduran military says that there are daily meetings between Negroponte and Alvarez, the head of the army, in order to plan the covert war against Nicaragua. They meet daily on that particular issue. A second dynamic is that the human rights situation in Honduras has deteriorated drastically. In 1982, the Honduran Catholic Church, that is generally quite conservative and uninvolved in political issues, has begun denouncing human rights violations in Honduras. And that is quite remarkable, considering the very conservative nature of the Honduran church. And especially involved in denouncing disappearances and extended detentions of people without charges, which is clearly against the Honduran constitution. I mean, there is a democratic constitution in Honduras. Land scarcity continues as a major problem in Honduras. There was land reform in Honduras, a land reform of sorts in the early 1970s, which has contributed to the relative peace in Honduras, the lack of a revolutionary movement in Honduras up until this point. The U.S., of course, has supported land reforms in the past to the extent that they keep people quiet, not so that there's genuine distribution, but so that there's enough distribution to keep people quiet. And that was certainly the case in the early 70s in Honduras. However, there are 75 to 100,000 new rural families that will populate the countryside by 1990, and the already desperate situation of the rural poor will become hopeless unless there's not some major attempt at a new, genuine land reform. Another dynamic that's very important to understand in Honduras is that over 30,000 refugees have taken refuge in Honduras as a result of the region's violence. There are 17,000 Salvadorans in Honduras. There are 10,000 Nicaraguans, most of them Miskito Indians, who came across the border when the Sandinistas moved the Miskito Indians, and about 1,000 Guatemalans. The Salvadorans are essentially located in two settlement camps, one here in Colomancagua, and another in a settlement in Mesa Grande, which is about here, fairly close to the Salvadoran border. Most of the Miskito refugees are in this part of the country, on the other side.
Why would the Salvadorans be there? The governments are similar.
The Salvadorans are refugees from the war in El Salvador, and basically those who have supported the rebel movements. Okay, so there is a very hostile response of the Honduran government to these refugees, and I'll talk about that. The presence has provoked very contradictory policies toward these refugee groups. There's a very close relationship, as you indicated, Paul, with the Salvadoran military and the Honduran government. So that's created a hardline approach to the Salvadoran refugees. All right. In fact, joint military operations between the Honduran and El Salvadoran militaries in 1980 and 1981 resulted in two massacres of El Salvadoran refugees along the Sumpul and the Lempa rivers, which are right in this border area. Several hundred El Salvadoran refugees were massacred as they tried to cross these borders. And it was clearly a joint operation by the militaries of Salvador and Honduras. That is, the Honduran military lining up on one side, preventing them from coming across. As they tried to come across, they were strafed by planes in the river. There's some just incredible stories of what happened in those events. It's gruesome. The Salvadorans live in their settlement camps really as if they were in prison. They're restricted to their camps at Mesa Grande and Colomancagua. They're trying to develop somewhat of a basic infrastructure at Mesa Grande, but at Colomancagua the situation is still quite desperate. These camps are administered by the United Nations High Commission on Refugees, but the United Nations High Commission is under a great deal of criticism in Honduras right now because their policy is to always follow the host government's policies with regard to refugees. And so the host government's policies in this case, which is obviously a reflection of U.S. government's policies, is differentiating treatment of Salvadoran and Nicaraguan refugees. While the Salvadorans are subject to this kind of extreme control, this is not true of the Nicaraguan refugees. The Salvadorans, it's important to recognize, have fled for their lives from the Salvadoran military. That's why they're refugees. The acknowledgement of their legitimate status, if their presence, let me back up a minute, and if you're getting confused, you raise your hand so I can straighten it out. I'm getting confused as I talk about it. All right, the Salvadorans are in Honduras because they're fleeing from a repressive military in Salvador. For Honduras to recognize their legitimate status means for Honduras to recognize that the El Salvadoran government is, in fact, repressing its people. You follow that? That's also the reason the United States will not recognize the legitimate status of Salvadoran refugees, and it's important to recognize that refugee policy in Honduras is not determined solely by the Honduran government, but by the United States government as well. The Miskito Indian refugees from Nicaragua, however, while they didn't really flee for personal safety reasons, they fled more for political reasons, their disagreement with the Nicaraguan government, they are firmly anti-Sandinista, and they provide a solid group of people who know the terrain and who are very willing to cooperate in any military actions against Nicaragua. So they get different treatment. They have been distributed into the community. Much more of the actual material aid has gone to the Nicaraguan refugees than has gone to the Salvadoran refugees. And that's part of the reason for the UNHCR, the United Nations High Commission, criticism that they've received is because they have helped to carry out this policy, ostensibly the policy of the Honduran government, but obviously also the policy of the U.S. government. Now, is that clear, that problem of differentiation of treatment of Salvadoran refugees and Nicaraguan refugees? It's important to recognize this tie-in between U.S. policy and the treatment of refugees. It was also quite striking for me to discover when we went to the U.S. Embassy that the U.S., the refugee officer at the U.S. Embassy is also the political officer, who is also, political officers are traditionally CIA. Now, that's a very interesting connection, I think, that the situation of refugees is a very, very political issue. I don't want to get into it now, but the whole, I think one of the things this whole refugee question in Honduras brings up is the status of Salvadoran and Guatemalan refugees in this country as well, an issue which the church has started to become aware of, that Salvadoran refugees, and there are many thousands of them in this country, are not granted refugee status. And plane loads are being sent back to Salvador, where their lives are very desperately in danger. Why are they not granted refugee status? For the same reason as here. To grant them refugee status acknowledges that the Salvadoran government is a repressive government in which these people are in danger. And that is contrary to U.S. foreign policy. Current U.S. policy has contributed toward the militarization of Honduras and the continuation of hostilities in that region. The policy toward Honduras focuses little on the country itself and more on how Honduras can help the United States achieve policy objectives elsewhere. With U.S. encouragement, Honduras is cooperating with anti-Sandinista forces, using Honduras as a base of attack. And the Honduran army is providing logistical support and cover fire for attacks on Nicaragua. The U.S. policy, I think, with its emphasis on militarization in Honduras, is negligent in that it really is helping to bring about the death of democracy in Honduras, a democracy that it says it is attempting to preserve. Further, I think that this policy is really laying the foundation for a more violent and bloody regional war within, some say the next decade, but the way things are moving, within the next few months. The manipulation of Honduras in this struggle is devastating not only for Honduras itself, but for the whole region. I think I'll stop there. Because in previous days we haven't had a lot of chance for discussion, and give some chance for a discussion of this issue. Right? Yeah.
The United States government, in your opinion, supports the military regime in Honduras in order to protect you've not said this, but our fruit companies down there?
That's part of it, but that's not the main issue. I mean, it's certainly we're protecting the fruit companies up in Honduras. But the reason we're supporting Honduras is that it's very key for our strategy for all three of these countries. Our presence in Honduras is primarily to be a base from which to attack the Nicaraguan government and to be a base for which to support the governments of El Salvador and Guatemala.
But we don't have much multinational stuff in Nicaragua. Why do we have to...
Well, because we do have quite a bit in Guatemala, for one. Guatemala, I think, in terms of economic interest, is key. And I'm going to talk more about this tomorrow, the why of U.S. foreign policy. But I'll just open the door to that today, and that is to suggest I think the real issues are ideological. That we're seeing the crisis in Central America as a reflection of an East-West struggle, a struggle against the Soviet Union, and that any attempt at anything, at a new form of government that doesn't follow U.S. lines, as the government of Nicaragua is doing, is really serving Soviet interests. I mean, I think it's part of the dualistic mentality of the U.S., of the Reagan administration. So I think you're right that the U.S. economic interests in Central America are not the primary basis upon which this policy is being formed, although it's a factor. You know, there's fruit companies in Guatemala, they've discovered oil reserves. The primary reasons, I think, are ideological. And I'm going to dig into that more tomorrow, I hope. What are the basis of these ideological differences, and what's the results of that? Yes? Yeah,
I think you hit on a key point. And just an observation that, from my limited understanding, if one believes that the Marxist-Leninist dogma of historical inevitability is one which they must pursue to be faithful to their principles, then it is difficult to come to the conclusion that they are not somehow encouraging all rebel movements anywhere in the world. I think this is really the crux of the matter. Where you come down on this depends on whether you believe that or whether you don't. And I don't know, pretend to know the answer, but I think that's really what it all turns on. Reagan, of course, I think that's what is right. Behind every move of his.
Right.
If any type of communism, boy, the flag runs up for him and he reacts. And you're going to talk about that more.
Yeah, I'll talk about that more tomorrow. But I think the question, I don't think there's any question about the fact that there's, that these movements in Central America are Marxist in their social and political philosophy, that there's influence of Marxism in that. But I think it's also become increasingly clear that it's a very homegrown kind of Marxism. Doesn't mean that these struggles are not supported, philosophically and so forth by Cuba and the Soviet Union to whatever degree that they might be, although there are a lot of ideological differences that emerge as well. But what's really at stake here, I think, is whether or not the United States can live with certain forms of socialism, or whether we will inevitably push these countries to a closer dependence on the Soviet Union, because I think that's what's at stake in Nicaragua. A country that has clearly indicated it does not want to be aligned with the Soviet Union, that it wants friendly relationships with all nations, and whether or not we will push them increasingly towards the Soviet Union. Does our policy, in fact, a self-fulfilling one of that very thing, you know? Or is there really a possibility of some alternative views of how socialism can manifest itself?
I think the Reagan administration would equate socialism with totalitarianism.
Yes, exactly.
Which is much different.
And many Latin Americans have come to associate totalitarianism with capitalism.
Right.
Because of what they've seen have been the reality of capitalism in these countries, the kind of dictatorships that have existed.
But what kind of...
You first and then Mary.
Well, you've talked a lot about the Reagan administration. How has that changed from what Carter did in his...
That's a good question. I think we do see some changes that have some impact. One is Carter's human rights policy as... uneven and unevenhandedly, there's a better word than that, what is it? as it was implemented, did give, especially Latin America, something to hang on to, all right? It was something that could be used as a policy for many groups that gave them force in their struggle. So I think the elimination of any kind of real human rights policy has been an important change. Now, I think there has been still the same tendencies to see this struggle in East-West terms, or at least dimensions of it, among all previous administrations. And in fact, we were talking today, the difference in the Democratic and Republican Party approach to the situation in Nicaragua is more one of question of how should we respond. Both of them saying that we really don't like what's going on in Nicaragua. Okay,
it's so just a method of competition.
It's just a method. It's a method of, and the Democrats wanting to be seen as being associated with losing Central America, quote unquote. I think Reagan represents an extreme, and a very dangerous extreme, in his position on this issue. But I think it's a policy that has, there's certain consistencies that run throughout all of U.S. policy towards Central America. I mean, just the way we think about the region, we constantly refer to it as our backyard.
How about the Monroe Doctrine?
Well, sure, the Monroe Doctrine, same thing. But just that phrase, our backyard, first of all, that it's ours, somehow. You know, and then it's our backyard. It's something back here. It's not that significant, you know. That whole possessive kind of attitude that we have the arrogance to think it's ours. It's Mary, you were gonna.
What triggered when the Honduran people elected their president? What triggered the United States feeling that we then have to support the military?
It happened long before that. I think it was part of the U.S. plan that we elect a military government, that a military government be elected in Honduras as the kind of facade by which we could say that Honduras is a democracy. That is, arrangements were made before that election between Suazo Cordova and the military. Most observers who have been in Honduras say that's exactly what happened. And while the election was a free one, it was not, it was very much in the U.S. plan that a civilian be elected, just as we wanted to get a civilian in El Salvador. But it was the plan from the start that what we would really do is reinforce the military in that scheme of things. You understand what I mean? That that was part of the plan from the start.
How did the people feel?
The people in Honduras, you have a wide range of feelings on that. You have some people who have been really, there's a tremendous propaganda campaign going on in Honduras against the Sandinistas, against Nicaragua. And if you talk about freedom in the press in Nicaragua, there's much less freedom in the press in Honduras. I mean, it's very tightly controlled by the government. It's very strongly anti-Nicaragua. And so there is a strong fear among some sectors of the Honduran people about Nicaragua. On the other hand, there are many broad group of Honduran people who are very fearful that their country's policy is leading them into war with Nicaragua. And nobody wants war with Nicaragua either. So there's the country's divided on their feelings about Nicaragua and their feelings of U.S. involvement in Honduras. There are some people who say we ought to have three U.S. bases. You know, that's the only way we're going to be protected. But what's very interesting is even those people who are very much supportive of U.S. involvement in Honduras, it's almost unanimous the understanding of what I was saying earlier about the chain of command in Honduras. That it is Negro Ponte, then Alvarez, then Suazo Cordova. None of the Honduran people are under the illusion they really have a civilian government, nor that they even have a self-determined government, that it is in fact the U.S. that is dictating most of what's happening in Honduras.
Are they as adamant as the Nicaraguans against U.S. involvement?
No, I mean, that's what I'm saying. Part of them are for U.S. involvement, even though they recognize they're calling the shots. What is different about Honduras, and this is what's very hard to articulate, unless one is there, is to sense the difference in the kind of feelings of hope and inspiration and participation in the process between the differences that one feels between the Honduran and the Nicaraguan people. There is just in Nicaragua one senses an excitement, a commitment to a struggle, a sort of exuberance, even in the midst of the situation in which Nicaragua finds itself, in a situation of attack. In Honduras, among the base people now, there's a kind of a resignation, an overall kind of depression by the situation in which they find themselves. It's a very, very different feeling that one gets from the people of these two countries. Yeah, Bob?
I can ask a couple of questions. The first is, haven't we learned anything from our China policy? It seems that that breaks the assumption that there is only one socialism, and that's Soviet dominated.
Yeah.
And the second, you suggested that we were interested in land reform in Honduras only to the point of pacifying the people. I would question that. It seemed to me that if land reform didn't contradict our military and political policies there, we would want as much land reform as possible to make this a model in Central America of an American type of democracy and capitalism.
Except that we really don't want replicas of U.S. capitalism and democracy in Latin America because we couldn't control them.
I see.
All right? What we want is control. We don't want models of... I mean, we don't want for them what we've got. Okay? What we want is to be able to control them, really. And so that means we want enough land reform so that the people have enough land or have expectations enough that they're going to get land that they won't rebel, but we don't want enough land reform so that the people really have power. Because in order to continue our influence in this region, we're dependent on the power being still basically in the hands of an elite, of an elite economic group or an elite military group, usually a combination of both.
That's pretty harsh, but,
I know it's pretty
harsh. I mean, harsh because then you can say that really our policy is not different, very different from Soviet East Bloc policy. We actually don't annex countries, but we do try to play the same
game. I think if I were pushed to it, that's probably what I would say. That in the end, we're certainly viewed in the third world as not much different in terms of our kind of imperialist extensionist policies than is the Soviet Union. And I want to be very clear about that. I would come down just as harshly on the Soviet Union on these kinds of issues as I would with on the United States. And I mean in terms of their policies in Afghanistan, Poland, and so forth. But what we've done on this issue is if we look at the Reagan administration's rhetoric, we attacked as Soviet Union for their policies in Poland and Afghanistan. We call those people freedom fighters, and we call people in Salvador guerrillas and terrorists. And I think the dynamics are very much the same.
But we try to remain a little more covert.
Right. Yes. Although increasingly not so.
Is our need to control Central America a fear of the Soviet bloc?
I think it's a fear of the Soviet bloc. I think it is to a certain extent our fear of losing influence economically in the region. I mean, when you look at Latin America as a whole, it's a very important economic entity for us. And what happens in Central America is either going to give inspiration or put the lid on expectations of the rest of Latin America. I think it's critical in that sense. Yeah.
You've talked about the role of the Roman Catholic Church quite a bit. Now, the evangelical movement, as they've come to call themselves, has become quite a force. And usually,
especially in
the Pentecostalism, I think the president of Guatemala represents that position. Are you going to comment a bit about that?
Yeah, I can a little bit. I think, to a certain extent, the evangelical movement has come to really be and represent, and some people suggest is very closely tied to U.S. foreign policy at this point. The government of Honduras, of course, a born-again Christian Rios Montt, who's tied to a very conservative evangelical sect based in California.
You met Guatemala, didn't you?
What did I say?
Honduras.
Oh, sorry, yeah, Guatemala.
Yeah.
CBS, I believe it was, did a documentary on the ties of Rios Montt to Jerry Falwell and the whole moral majority in the United States and the tremendous amount of funding that's come into Guatemala because of that. Well, that suggests some very close political ties as you look at the political nature of the moral majority in the United States.
the evangelical church, certainly in Guatemala, has had that kind of effect. Now, that's not one can't generalize that across all of Latin America. Now, in Nicaragua, for example, there's an organization called CEPAD, which is the umbrella organization for all of the Protestant churches, kind of that coordinates their social service efforts. CEPAD now has taken a cautiously supportive stance with respect to the Nicaraguan government. Sort of a critical support, but a friendly stance. Working with the Nicaraguan government, involved in the political process, even though that they're coordinating 40-some denominations who are quite conservative, many of them. And yet there seems to be an ability to, even within that sector in Nicaragua, to tolerate a very progressive political point of view. And you see, within certain sectors of the Protestant Church in throughout Latin America, a very strong critical voice with respect to U.S. foreign policy and in calling for basic social changes. You still see some very conservative dimensions of that. So generally, I think the evangelical church has a more conservative stance in Latin America, but it also has far less influence. It's still very, very much a minority. But I think what's happening in Guatemala is very, very interesting, because there it's getting tied to a very sort of legitimizing a very, very repressive regime, and with very clear links to the U.S. Conservative evangelical.
Any Lutheran voices down there?
Yes, there are. In fact, in Central America, some very interesting ones that are emerging. The church that's had the most input, the most presence in Central America, has been the Missouri Synod, interestingly enough. And there's a group of Missouri Synod pastors now that have started the process of meeting, in some respects, much to the chagrin of their own denomination, because, of course, the Missouri Synod now has not taken a progressive stance with regard to Central America, but who have in fact, I wish I had a copy of their statement. Came out with a statement 6 months ago when they're really calling for the solidarity of the church in North America, the Lutheran Church, and are finding themselves having to pull together because of the lack of support of their own church. And in some respects being embraced by the ALC in some of the things that they want to do. Now, also many of you may be aware of the fact that one of these pastors, Medardo Gomez, was recently arrested in San Salvador, and together with him a Lutheran doctor, Dr. Ibarra. Medardo Gomez has been very involved in working with Salvadoran refugees at a refugee camp in San Salvador that's sponsored by the Lutheran Church of the Resurrection in San Salvador. And so I've taken some very courageous stands, and of course Dr. Ibarra is still in jail. When the U.S. Embassy is asked about Ibarra's relief, the common or standard response is, don't worry about him, he's a communist. Because they say he was involved in treating some of the people in one of the military groups forming the FMLN. Now, people who were at Lutheran Church of the Resurrection say, well, he may have been, we don't know, but we don't know when he did it, because he practically spent 24 hours a day at the refugee camp. So a very committed person, but who is, somebody called up the State Department in Washington to ask about him and got that same response. He's a communist, we're not going to worry about him. And he's a Salvadoran citizen, so the U.S. Embassy isn't going to do anything about it, obviously. But, so the Lutherans, there's a increasing, one of the things that's been very interesting as we've been leading increasing numbers of Lutheran groups to Central America, there's been a sort of awakening within the American Lutheran Church of Central American issues. And now, as many of you may know, we're going to be leading a group of American Lutheran Church bishops in September on a 3-week trip to Brazil, Nicaragua, Brazil, Panama, Nicaragua, and then they'll divide into 3 groups for 3 days going to Salvador, Honduras, and Guatemala. So those of you in the American Lutheran Church in these districts are probably going to hear some sort of response from your bishop on these issues, if you haven't already. And I think that's a very significant step on the part of the American Lutheran Church in this country. I should also mention that in the statements of the Lutherans, Latin American Lutherans in Central America, one of the things that they were calling for is more education and advocacy work in the United States on Central American issues. Not, you know, send pastors here or even send aid here, but a kind of a presence with them in their struggle and education and advocacy effort in the United States to try to understand the real issues at work in Central America. So here you see, I think, something that really pastors that come out of a very conservative tradition, Missouri Synod tradition, who, because of their experience, and this has been the history of the church, very conservative people. Archbishop Romero was the same way, a very conservative man who, because of their experience of walking alongside the poor, seeing their struggles, understanding, are finally come to the conclusion that there has to be change. And to even see these Lutheran pastors now in that same situation is, I think, very, very interesting and important for us as Lutherans.
Do you have official relations with Amnesty International? Do you coordinate that?
No, we don't. To this point, we haven't had. Obviously, you know, we're very interested in their work, but have had no official relationations with them.
Are you aware of any effect? For example, you mentioned this doctor.
He's a Lutheran doctor, Salvadoran, who's been involved with Lutheran Church of the Resurrection, who was arrested and has been detained now and is in non-federal prison.
Yeah,
nobody knows for how long.
Precisely the kind of Amnesty International.
Right. Yeah.
Have they picked up this?
That I'm not sure. There's been lots of Lutheran involvement. This has been involvement, even the Lutheran World Federation has been involved in this case. And I don't know to what extent Amnesty has been involved.
When you speak of the Lutheran Church of the Resurrection, are you thinking of a congregation?
That's a congregation in San Salvador.
Oh,
that's right. It has Missouri Synod roots originally, but it's a very, and that whole congregation is very active in working with Salvadoran refugees.
I wanted to ask about this House of Representatives votes. Specifically, what does this do? Suppose the Senate does not approve it.
Yeah.
Now, are they appropriating money, or
no,
is it to cease operations?
It's to cease operations. My understanding at this point is the vote is more symbolic than anything. I mean, it's saying to Reagan, you just don't have a free license to carry out this policy. Now, what it means in actuality, I'm not sure. I don't understand enough of the context in which this vote is taking place. What happens if the Senate does not approve? It's undoubtedly some sort of compromise will have to be worked out. Nevertheless, it is a voice that Reagan is going to have to deal with. You know, if he continues this, see, my hunch is that he can't act as strongly, because if he acts more strongly, then Congress will be more strong in its response.
Congressional opposition.
Yeah, right. So I wish I could answer that more clearly, but I can't.
What is 220 to 200?
198, yeah.
Since the House of Representatives is predominantly Democratic, and even by nature, the Democrats would be more opposed,
right,
that the Senate would have difficulty in passing.
I think so. I think that's true. But what the hopeful side of it, the thing is, lately you just try to look for something hopeful in all of this, is that it was expected that it was going to be an extremely close vote, and nobody was predicting how that was going to go. So in this sense, it's stronger than expected. The response is stronger than expected. So
who has ultimate control of the CIA? Is it Congress?
Well, that's a good question, and I think one of the questions that Congress is beginning to ask. You know, there's both Senate and House Intelligence Oversight Committees, and they're the ones who are kind of monitor CIA activity, but nobody's quite sure of the kind of autonomy that they have.
But
you know,
control the finances. So.
They control, well, but see, that's a question. You know, it appears that the CIA has a great deal of discretionary funds that they can use however they want. You know, and that's been the history. You know, that there's, I think probably it's a situation where Congress can vote to say you can't use it. But unless they vote to say you can't use it, they can use it for whatever
they
want.
Who's going to abolish the CIA if they want to? Don't know.
I don't know. Congress, I suppose. Yeah.
Even though the president appoints the people there, the leadership of the CIA is under his control, more or less. Congress last year took it away from him.
Yeah.
More or less, as far as the vote was.
Well, let's stop. Tomorrow, the final session in this series, I want to focus squarely on U.S. foreign policy. We've danced around it. We've talked about it in various ways. I'm going to lay out, if I haven't been clear by my position till this point, which I think I have, it's going to be very clear tomorrow. And I'm going to talk about what I think are the reasons for U.S. foreign policy in the region, what I think its consequences are going to be, and what I think some alternatives might be tomorrow. And then again, give you a chance for some discussion. Thanks.
I can't be here tomorrow.